it for 3 or 4 more wounded. Ainsworth volunteered to do the pickup with the command ship. Says Ainsworth, "By the grace of God, I didn't take a hit. I flew in and out through that wall of tracers and did not take a single round. I figured I was one of the luckiest pilots who ever flew in NAM. Never a hit the whole time." Now the Albany clearing perimeter could settle down for what was left of the night. About 5 soldiers made it into the perimeter during the night, Rick Riscuola recalls. Larry Gwynn pointed southeast and said what is left of the rest of the battalion is out there in 3 main groups and then smaller teams. I walked up to the lone figure of Lieutenant Gordon Grove, standing in the northwest corner of the perimeter. He was a former sergeant who had come up through OCS. "My platoon's out there," he said. "I came back in to get help, but I was ordered not to go back." He was desolate. He kept looking at the tree line as if expecting his men to show up. After midnight, several shots rang out from inside the perimeter. A trooper 20 yards behind Riscuola, inside the perimeter, had rattled off a panicky 3 rounds. Riscuola walked back and cussed out the group in the middle of the perimeter. "If I hear one more round out of you, we will turn our weapons around and open up." No one fires from inside the perimeter. "If you want to fire, get out of the perimeter line." Whispered communication took place all night between isolated elements outside the perimeter. If there was heroism, it was out there in the tiny groups of wounded and those who bandaged and protected them through the long night. "They were just like hunting buddies," says Riscuola, "surviving by instinct, looking out after each other." In the perimeter, there was discussions about taking out a night patrol, as was being done by Captain Forrest's company at the end of the column. Riscuola recalls, "The idea of crossing through the chaos of the battlefield at night presented problems. We would have to deplete the perimeter. Scare shooting by friendlies was a threat. There was reason to believe the enemy was still effective. Finally, moving the wounded would achieve little unless they could be evacuated immediately. Wait until dawn became the command watchword." Lieutenant Larry Gwynn of Alpha Company recalls that late that night, one of Alpha's missing men crawled into the American perimeter. "Sergeant James A. Millardi from our 1st platoon made it back to our lines. His story. The NVA had been shooting our wounded. One came up to him, stuck a pistol in his mouth, and fired. The bullet exited the back of his throat, knocked him out, and they left him for dead. He survived, and when he woke up at night, he started crawling to us." As dawn broke over the Albany battlefield on Friday, November 18th, a profound shock awaited the Americans who had survived the night. To this point, no one had a clear picture of the extent of the losses suffered by the 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry. They were about to find out. Captain Joel Sugdinis, the commander of Alpha Company 2nd Battalion 7th Cav, remembers that at dawn on the 18th, the area was quiet, though not comfortable. "We did the mad minute and it evoked no response. We began to slowly move forward to recon the areas out from the perimeter. No opposition. The battlefield was quiet. We collected as many of our dead as we could. The North Vietnamese had paid dearly, but so had we." The American dead were retrieved and brought back to the island perimeter wrapped in ponchos, tagged, and literally stacked like cordwood. When the Chinook helicopters arrived to remove them, I remember the flight crews were stunned at the cargo. We buried none of the enemy. The battlefield was acquiring that pronounced smell of death. Lieutenant Gwynn, Sugdinis's executive officer, says, "The next day was the real nightmare. As we went out to find our dead and missing, I think each of us cracked up a little bit that day as the true picture of the action began to unfold. Then it came across the radio. Bravo Company had found one other survivor from our 2nd platoon. He had been badly wounded in the legs and had propped himself up against the tree. He had been burned by napalm waiting in the night how some North Vietnamese had put a pistol to his eye and pulled the trigger. Shot him in the eye, blinded him, but he was still alive. I saw him being brought in on a stretcher, smoking a cigarette, all fucked up. As they policed up our dead, bringing them in, I lost it. Lieutenant Gwynn admits, I heard that Don Cornette had been killed, and that broke my emotional back. I heard the Charlie Company was basically annihilated. That became evident. I saw where our first platoon had been, and there was just bodies all over the place, already bloating in the sun. I went to the second platoon area, and we found three of our men all lying together, terribly shot up and clearly hit by napalm. I suppressed those memories for 15 years. The terrible task of policing up the battlefield fell to Captain Myron Diderich's Bravo Company troops and Captain George Forrest's Alpha Company, 1st of the 5th. Diderich wrote, "Next day, the 18th, I made a tour of the battlefield, and I'll tell you, it was a hell of a grim sight to see. North Vietnamese and U.S. bodies all over intermingled. It was a hell of a fight. Some North Vietnamese were bayoneted. Again, the grim task of recovering friendly dead. This time there were many more. It took the better part of the 18th and 19th to accomplish this." Specialist 4 Dick Ackerman of the recon platoon remembers, "Just before daylight at the Albany clearing, the word was spread. Do not leave your holes. Do not get up and walk around. At the command, there will be a mad minute. Somebody was thinking. When the time arrived, we opened up. The envoy started jumping up and running, falling out of trees. I don't think this was their main force, possibly just a rear guard group. Then we started spreading out. I was on perimeter defense to enable others to pick up wounded behind us. There was sporadic shooting. What we saw as we expanded our perimeter was unbelievable. The bodies, complete and in pieces, were everywhere. Some were still alive. The NVA came into the ambush area at night to recover the dead and wounded. When they found any of our guys alive, they would beat them to death, bayonet them, or machete them to avoid shooting and drawing fire from us. We policed up all day and pulled back into the circle for the night. Next day, the 19th, we did the same thing, except I was on pickup duty, not perimeter guard." Doc William Schuchart hiked up the shattered column from the Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 5th Cavalry perimeter to the Albany clearing perimeter the morning of the 18th. On the way, we found guys scattered all over the place, wounded, who had spent the night out there by themselves. They were so calm. I was thinking, I spent the night with 30 or 40 guys, and even with all that company, I was scared shitless. If I had been out in the woods alone like these guys, I would have been scared to death. They were amazing. Lieutenant Pat Payne, the recon platoon commander, says, "We moved out very carefully and started finding all our dead and wounded as soon as possible. One of the greatest losses was Lieutenant Don Cornette. I saw his body. He was laid out alongside the edge of the LZ on his stomach. His face was turned to the side. He looked like he was asleep. A helicopter landed and it stirred the wind. Cornette's hair blew in the breeze, and it was beyond my comprehension that such a wonderful person had been killed. I covered him up with his poncho and then helped carry his body to the chopper." Captain Skip Fessmeyer, commander of Charlie Company. "In sweeping through the area at first light, we found dead American and NVA soldiers locked in mortal combat. Charlie Company, under the control of Lieutenant Don Cornette, had moved forward on the right flank of Delta Company and met head in the hasty attack of the North Vietnamese. Strewn over the battlefield were numerous dead enemy, along with 50 dead and 50 wounded soldiers of Charlie Company and almost all of Sig Dinis's lead platoon." Specialist Jack P. Smith, one of Charlie Company's wounded. "In the morning, the place looked like the devil's butcher shop. There were people hanging out of trees. The ground was slippery with blood. Men who were my closest friends were all around me dead. Then they started to call in artillery and they came and got us. They wrapped me in a poncho and carried me to a helicopter, and I was whisked out of there. I was taken to Japan, and it all passed. I came back to Vietnam. I didn't see any more combat and left eventually. When I came home on leave, my parents were delighted to see me. A couple of days later, I was watching the evening news, and lo and behold, I saw my company jumping out of helicopters, and I burst into tears and ran out of the room. Lieutenant Rescorla had a different reaction to the mad minute fired at dawn. This decision was regrettable. Rifle fire shattered the silence, and the perimeter was ringed with reckless firing. Little thought had been given that the remainder of our survivors were sprawled among the trees and anthills within 500 yards, the effective range of our M16s. What the fuck is happening? Are you shooting at us? The frantic radio call started coming in. How many troops were killed or injured by our wake-up call will never be known. Thank God for the trees, anthills, uneven terrain. Rescorla took a path down the western flank of what had been the battalion column. He called it a long, bloody traffic accident in the jungle. One trooper dead with weapons laid out next to him, pack of cigarettes clenched in his hand. Further on, I noticed an officer wearing a ranger patch. It was Don Cornette. He had been shot several times. Individual troopers looked as if they had not yet received the order to move out. Mortar men were dead, sitting upright against anthills, rounds still on their backs, as if they were caught during a break. Here and there, between American bodies, lay smaller khaki figures. Coming round an anthill, I saw a concentration of NBA khaki bodies. A movement. I fired twice, and we advanced slowly. Three of them. Two riflemen dead. One wearing a pith helmet was very young, with a soft, round-featured face, lying belly up. He was dying, eyes flickering, shirt soaked with blood. They had all been wounded and had drawn close together a team of some kind. Charlie or Delta had given them their first crippling wounds. On the dying enemy soldier, Rescorla noticed something shiny. A big, battered, old French army bugle carrying a manufacture date of 1900, and the legend Quenon en Compagnie. Fournisseur de l'Armée, 94 Rue d'Anquayem, Paris. On some long-ago battlefield, perhaps Dien Bien Phu, the victorious Viet Minh had taken as a trophy, and marked their own legend, two crude Chinese characters tattooed onto the brass bell with nail point. Rough translation, long and powerful service. Now, here in the valley of the Yadrang, in the tall elephant grass, the trophy had changed hands again. The 7th Cavalry had a bugle once more, and Bravo Company, 2nd Battalion, would blow it time and again on the battlefields of Vietnam. Captain Dudley Tatamy, 3rd Brigade Fire Support Coordinator, remembers flying out to Albany at first light the next morning. Tim Brown, myself, Mickey Parrish, took a while to get in through the smoke hanging over the whole area. Not much had really taken place in terms of policing the area. The image that is still vivid in my mind is the carnage. Folks were still sitting around in a daze. They hadn't done much, hadn't even taken ponchos and covered up these bodies. I could handle the conversation, I could handle grown men crying, but we are talking 12 hours later. Sitting there feeling sorry for themselves. Colonel Brown was very pissed off. Even if you get caught in a bad situation, you have to do something to recover. It was young kids who paid the price. In later years, I used to stress that to my young battery commanders. It isn't us who die in combat, it's those young kids who die. Those kids we are responsible for training and leading. It's our job to get the job done and get those kids home safe. Colonel Brown recalls that visit to Albany on November 18th. The next morning, I finally got into that place. They were busy figuring out who was dead, who was wounded. They never got an accurate count for 48 hours or so. I stayed out there, wandering around, looking while they were bringing the bodies back in. Myron Diderich was checking them off. I never saw McDade. I asked where he was, where the command post was, but it was all confusion and nobody could tell me where he was. Diderich seemed to have things under control. When I got back, I sent Shai Meyer back out to see if he could make any more sense of it than I had. Captain Buse Tully of Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 5th Cav, and Captain George Forrest of the same battalion's Alpha Company had loggered their companies together overnight in the tail-end perimeter, venturing out only on the after-midnight patrol to find Ghost 4-6 and all those wounded Charlie Company, 2nd Battalion, 7th Cav soldiers. Captain Tully wrote, "With daylight, resupply and medevac ships arrived and we moved out toward the 2nd Battalion, 7th Cav position. The battle area was a scene of carnage. One of the few North Vietnamese found alive when offered assistance attempted to throw a hand grenade. He was shot. We also found GIs who obviously had been given the coup de grace, hands tied behind their backs and bullet holes in the backs of their heads. The link-up had been made at 9 a.m. From then until 2 p.m. we patrolled out of Albany, picking up dead and wounded personnel and enemy and friendly weapons. The job wasn't finished when we had to leave in order to make it back to LZ Columbus and our parent battalion's control by nightfall. Both the 1st Battalion 5th Cav companies made the march back to Columbus without incident, closing in at 5 p.m., well before dark, on November 18th. Columbus was a good-sized rectangular clearing running north-south. George Forrest's A Company moved into position on the northwest, while Buse Tully's B Company men secured the southern end of the clearing. Tully immediately put out observation posts forward of his 3-platoon defenses. Then he told his men to break out sea rations and take a well-deserved breather. Both the meal and the break were rudely interrupted at 5:35 p.m. when the outpost spotted the lead elements of a North Vietnamese force maneuvering toward Columbus. With that warning, Lieutenant Colonel Fred Ackerman, commander of the 1st Battalion 5th Cav, had time to get his men in their holes, alert the artillery batteries, and get set for the assault, which came in from the east and southeast. According to then-Lieutenant Colonel Nguyen Hu An, the NVA battlefield commander, that attack should have been launched against Columbus at 2 p.m., when half of Ackerson's battalion would still have been marching back from Albany. General An said the commander of the attack battalion of the 33rd Regiment was unable to mass his men, who had dispersed over a wide area of the valley to avoid airstrikes, in time to make the deadline. An said his commander also had problems finding a section of the Columbus perimeter where there was sufficient cover to hide his preparations for the attack. The result was a delay of over 3.5 hours. When the attack finally did kick off, it was met with a hail of rifle and machine gun fire from Ackerson's battalion as well as from the artillerymen who had cranked their 105mm howitzers down and were firing canister rounds at point-blank range. The Air Force was quick to provide tactical airstrikes close to the perimeter. By 9 p.m., the 1st Battalion 5th Cavalry had beaten off and broken the attack. An says, "The 33rd Regiment could not destroy this position, but they forced the artillery to withdraw, and the artillery men left behind about 1,000 rounds. We captured 1,000 rounds of 105mm ammunition. But we had no guns of that size and never used it." The North Vietnamese commander reckons that even though the attack failed, his men forced the abandonment of Columbus the next day. That's not the way Colonel Tim Brown, 3rd Brigade commander, sees it. "We were in our last days. The 2nd Brigade had already been ordered up. We were just swinging out west so that Colonel Ray Lynch, commander of the 2nd Brigade, could take over. We were also moving artillery out in that direction. Lynch was going to put his brigade headquarters at Duc Cu's Special Forces Camp. So we were in the process of getting out, but not yet." In furtherance of that plan, at midday on November 18th, Brown had sent Lieutenant Colonel Bautelli's 2nd Battalion, 5th Cav, on an air assault into a clearing designated landing zone Crooks, 6.5 miles northwest of Columbus. Once they had secured Crooks, Brown airlifted the artillery from LZ Falcon to Crooks. From there, the artillery men would provide initial support to the 2nd Brigade and to the South Vietnamese airborne battalions that were planning to move south from Duc Co Camp on November 19th and take up blocking positions along the Cambodian border to harass the North Vietnamese on the retreat from the Ia Drang Valley. On November 19th, Brown moved the artillery and the 1st Battalion 5th Cav from Columbus to a new landing zone designated Gulf, 7.5 miles northwest. Now all the pieces were in place for continued operations against the enemy, with Brown's 3rd Brigade handing off the job to Colonel Ray Lynch's 2nd Brigade and to the ARVN Airborne Task Force. Back in the Albany area, policing of the battlefield continued. Survivors and witnesses most often used the word carnage for the terrible things they saw in the brush and tall elephant grass. Specialist 4 John Wilenius of the Bravo Company, 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry Mortar Platoon, and most of the rest of Myron Diderich's men were involved in this macabre and depressing duty. It was incredible carnage. We went to areas where lots of artillery had come in during the night, and we saw our guys had been blown up in the trees. The bodies were already decomposed, and it had only happened the night before. We were in shock. It was the first, last, and only time I ever saw anything like it, and I pray never again. The stench was unbelievable. We started hauling in the whole bodies first. Then we brought in the pieces and parts. 2 Chinooks came in and we loaded one with about 20 corpses neatly arranged in litters. The pilot began preparing to take off. One of our officers pointed an M16 at the pilot and told him to keep the bird on the ground. We weren't through. Bodies were loaded floor to ceiling. When the ramp finally closed, blood poured through the hinges. I felt sorry for the poor bastards who would have to unload this chopper back at Holloway. One of the last wounded Americans recovered from the battlefield that day was PFC James Shatton of the Delta Company Mortar Platoon. The next morning and all day long, the sun had no mercy. The ants and flies were crawling all over my wounds. My tongue and throat had turned to cotton. I had grown so weak I could hardly move. Captain Henry Thorpe came to me about 6 p.m. the evening of the 18th and said, "We didn't know where you were." Well, I didn't know where he was either. After a few days at the 85th Evac Hospital, I was flown back to the hospital at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, where I stayed almost a year recovering. The nightmares born of this battle have never faded. Chapter 23. The Sergeant and the Ghost. We have good corporals and good sergeants and some good lieutenants and captains, and those are far more important than good generals. William Tecumseh Sherman. Every battle has its unsung heroes, and the desperate fight that raged up and down the column of Americans scattered along the trail to the Albany clearing is no exception. Two of them met after midnight, November 18th, when Platoon Sergeant Fred J. Klug, 32 years old, 1st Platoon, Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 5th Cavalry, led a patrol into the heart of the killing zone in search of the voice on the radio calling himself Ghost 4-6. Klug eased into a small cluster of wounded and desperate Americans and quietly asked, "Who's in charge here?" There was a long silence and then the faint reply, "Over here." 2nd Lieutenant Robert J. Jeanette, who had been wounded at least 4 times that afternoon, but had held onto his radio and called deadly barrages of artillery down on groups of North Vietnamese circling the Albany clearing, thought he had been saved. So he had, but not just yet. Ghost Force 6 and Sergeant Klug are the stuff of legend, and various versions of their sagas have circulated for years among the survivors of Albany. Literally dozens of men reckon they owe their lives to either the sergeant or the ghost. Both insist that they only did their jobs, that the real heroes were among all the others who fought in Albany that day and night. Sergeant Fred J. Klug was a 17-year-old high school dropout when he enlisted in the Army in 1950. He fought in the Korean War with the 187th Regimental Combat Team. Between the wars, Korea and Vietnam, he taught map reading and small unit infantry tactics in Army schools. In 1965, Klug was on his way to the Special Forces but ended up in the 1st Cavalry Division, assigned as a platoon sergeant in Alpha Company 1st Battalion 5th Cavalry, Captain George Forrest commanding. When the fighting broke out in the march to Albany clearing, Sergeant Klug helped establish the perimeter at the rear of the column and then single-handedly began finding and guiding to safety the Americans staggering out of the chopped-up column. Sergeant Klug's account. We started getting more and more wounded in from the column up ahead. I would go out and collect them. They were staggering out of the kill zone, dazed, badly wounded, shot up. I just moved off in that direction a good way so I can guide them back. The column up forward of us was gone. It had disintegrated. There was just independent little skirmishes going on, little pockets of men fighting back. I moved on up to where I could see into the kill zone and pick up those people coming out. Some of them were running, some crawling. Almost all of them were wounded. I could see the enemy up in the trees, and I could see them on the ground, moving along in groups of three or four, bent over low. They were moving like they had a destination to reach. Some of them shot at me, but mostly they were just moving along. What it looked like to me was their flanking units moving into the ambush zone. I picked up the surgeon of the 2nd Battalion 7th Cav, Doc Schuchart, about this time. I told him what we had going, and he started dealing with the wounded. By now, I started getting some choppers in. The medic, Specialist 5 Daniel Torres, told me that one of my squad leader sergeants had put a bandage on his leg, but Torres didn't think he was really wounded. I went over, and he was laying down. His pants leg slid up the side, and a bandage wrapped around his leg. I asked him, "How bad are you hit?" He said, "Oh, not too bad, just a flesh wound." I said, "Well, how about Torres and me take a look?" He said, "No, he didn't want anybody messing with it." I tore that bandage off, and there was no wound at all. Right then and there, I beat the shit out of him. I ripped his stripes off his arms and demoted him on the spot. I didn't have that authority, of course, but I sure relieved him of his job. I got his assistant squad leader and put him in charge. All this time, the doctor had gone on treating the wounded. Another captain, I believe an Air Force captain, came in our perimeter around then and asked what he could do. I put him with the doctor. The evac choppers were landing about 50 yards from where I had set up, about 200 yards from the kill zone. We had three or four choppers come in, one at a time, and I got all my wounded out, but more were coming out of the kill zone all the time, more than I was getting evacuated. A pilot called me over, told me there was a clearing 200 yards further back that was much bigger, where they could bring in two or three choppers at a time. I had my platoon pick up the wounded, and I sent a squad on ahead to recon that clearing, and we moved on back. It was a nice big clearing with a big anthill in the center. We set up a perimeter around that clearing, and I went forward again to guide the people coming out of the ambush. Lieutenant Adams and Captain Forrest both came back to us about then. Forrest was really upset. He had lost some friends in this. I was getting reports on who was dead from our company. One lieutenant killed and two lieutenants wounded. One platoon sergeant killed, one wounded. The executive officer wounded. A little later, Bravo Company 1-5 came in over land from Columbus, led by Captain Tully. He and Captain Forrest conferred, and they wanted my platoon to gather up all the wounded, maybe 35 or so, and prepare to move. Bravo Company would lead off. Tully wanted to go forward to the Albany clearing, through the ambush site. I told Tully, You won't make it even 100 yards up that trail. He didn't. They took real intense fire, lost one killed and several wounded. He decided that wasn't such a good idea after all, and pulled back. Tully and Forrest then decided to set up a joint two-company perimeter in the big clearing. At that point, we were holding the perimeter. Now Tully's people took over 3/4 of it and we kept the rest. Tully's people took the portion facing the ambush site. By now, we had gotten in most of the wounded from the ambush. Only a few straggled in later. I had piles of wounded men, and now the choppers told me they were going to quit flying. It was getting on to dark, and they said they wouldn't land after dark. I pleaded with them to at least bring us some ammunition. Most of the people coming in from the ambush didn't have weapons or ammo. They had dropped their harness and butt packs when they got hit. Some of my people carrying wounded had dropped their gear, too. I told that pilot I wanted grenades, trip flares, and ammo for the 16s and 60s. The pilot said okay, he would do that one last trip. He must have gone over to Columbus because he was back soon after. He didn't land, just made a low pass over the perimeter and kicked out crates of ammo. Captain Forrest had no radio, so we set up my platoon's radio over at the anthill. That's where Forrest set up his CP. I was expecting us to get hit. We were really vulnerable with so many wounded that couldn't move. I kept checking with the doctor and we tried to select an area where the wounded and the medics would be protected. Around 10 or 11 at night, Captain Forrest was fiddling around with the radio when he picked up a plea for help from Ghost 46. This was a 2nd Battalion 7th Cavalry lieutenant. I spoke to him both that night and again briefly in the morning. He was telling us over the radio that he was all shot up, that he was going to die, that the enemy were moving around, crawling around in the grass, killing off the American wounded. He said he could hear them shooting and talking out there around him. He said there were a bunch of other American wounded in the area. Captain Forrest wanted to take a patrol out to rescue them. I told him it wasn't all that good an idea. We discussed the pros and cons of it. The whole area was lit with flares. I told him there were a lot of arguments against it. Those people are closer to the Albany clearing than to us, and we have no contact with Albany. What if Albany has sent out a patrol, and we stumble into them and shoot each other up? The wounded Americans out in that grass are scared to death. They may shoot us up as well. Then there's the enemy, and if they don't shoot us, it's damn near guaranteed the Bravo Company guys on this perimeter will shoot us when we come back in. He insisted, "Sergeant, get your people saddled up." I said, "Okay, but there's no point in both of us going. They are my people. I'll take them out." It was arranged that Ghost 46 would fire his .45 caliber pistol, and I would guide in on the sound. The medevac guys had kicked out 4 or 5 folding-type litters. We got those and an M60 machine gun, and I took the whole bunch of us, 22 or 23 guys, I think. Captain Forrest stayed back. We traveled as light as we could. I told the guys to leave their steel pots, packs, all that stuff. Just carry rifles, ammo, and grenades. We went out through Tully's lines, and I retraced the route back to this ridge I had been on earlier, collecting the stragglers. Then we moved ahead real slow, with Ghost 46 firing his pistol. I didn't take a straight line up that column, but kind of looped around. We started finding dead everywhere. Mostly Americans at that point, on the outskirts of the kill zone, where they had run after they got shot. It was just thick with dead. Then we began to find some enemy dead among them. We picked up 3 or 4 American wounded on our way up to Ghost 46. If they could walk, we helped them along. We were already getting bogged down. We had no real capacity to react quickly if the enemy were to hit us. Well, we got to Ghost 46, and he was bad shot up, had been hit in the chest and hit in the knees. But of all the wounded we encountered, he was probably the most mentally alert and competent. I really admired him. That guy had a super attitude and spirit. We put up a little perimeter and started policing up the wounded and bringing them in. There were 25 or 30 or more that we brought in there. I had to make a decision. We could not take them all. There were too many of them. and I knew we would not be able to get back out there that night. There wasn't time enough before daylight. I asked Daniel Torres, the medic, to pick out those who were in the worst shape, who didn't look like making it through the night, for us to carry back, plus those who could walk on their own or with a little help. The rest we gathered close around Ghost 4-6. I told Ghost 4-6 I wasn't bringing him back on this trip, that I was putting him in charge of the others, and I would be back in the morning. He didn't like it, but he accepted it. Then I asked Torres if he would stay with them. He was the best soldier in my platoon, came from El Paso, Texas, and I thought the world of him. He didn't like the idea of staying out there either, but he said he would. I left Torres the M60 machine gun. We were gathering up ammo and weapons off the dead and putting those weapons beside the wounded so they could help defend themselves, if it came to that. When we told them we were only taking the worst wounded plus the walking wounded, some guys said, "I can walk," and got up. Some of them fell right back down, too. When I made the decision to carry out the worst cases, I was hoping that the choppers would come back in and collect those men. Turned out they wouldn't, and that's something that really pissed me off. Anyway, we started back in a straggling column. We had to stop every few minutes to let the walking wounded catch up. There were only three of us who were not carrying wounded, myself on point, and my radio operator and another guy riding shotgun at the rear. I was so apprehensive that the enemy would hit us now, when there was no way we could defend ourselves. Those carrying the wounded had their rifles slung on their backs. I was even more apprehensive about getting back inside our perimeter. That had worried me from the first minute. When we finally got close, I stopped everyone and we clustered in the shadows. I knew we were real close, less than 200 yards out from our lines. I was talking to Captain Forrest on the radio and telling him we were afraid to come in. We were afraid they were going to shoot us. Forrest came out to the line and shined a flashlight on his face. He was telling me, "We got everyone alerted. Everyone has got the word. Nobody's going to shoot." I kept saying we are afraid to move. So Forrest came out another 50 yards toward us, still shining that light in his face. Finally, I said, "Okay, we're coming in." We got everyone on their feet and we started in. We had got within a few feet of where Forrest was standing, and sure enough, somebody opened up on us from the Bravo Company 1-5 lines. It was a private in a foxhole, and he fired a whole magazine at us. He was firing low, got one guy in the hip and two others in their legs. When he finally emptied his magazine, we screamed at him and got it stopped, and we came on in. Turned out that guy had been asleep in his hole when they put the word out, and nobody woke him up to tell him. When he woke up and saw that column approaching, he figured we were NVA, and he opened fire. There's always the one guy who don't get the word, and that's the guy who shoots you up coming home. Always. And that was that. It was around 4 a.m., and for the rest of the night, we stayed in the perimeter and racked out. I fell asleep. Somebody woke me up before daybreak. The choppers were starting to come in for the wounded. Then Bravo Company 1-5 saddled up. We waited till all the wounded were evacuated and moved off behind Bravo through the ambush site. We never did get inside the Albany clearing. I could see it. Maybe 150 yards away. We identified our dead and brought them out. We went on up like we promised and got Ghost 4-6 and Daniel Torres, the medic, and that group of wounded. I spoke briefly with Ghost 4-6. "I told you I would come back for you, didn't I?" He still had a great attitude. I don't know if he lived or died, but if anyone had the will to get through, it was certainly that man. They brought in Hueys and Chinooks to pick up the dead. There were bodies everywhere, many of them messed up by the airstrikes, bomb strikes, artillery, ARA. I never saw anything in Korea that bad. Captain Forrest sent me out with a roster of the names of the men in our company and a man from each of the other two platoons, and we walked the battlefield looking at all the American dead. Then our men and the men from Bravo Company 2-7 got the duty of bringing them all in for evacuation. It was terrible, terrible. Some of them were in pieces from the air and artillery. We had to use entrenching tools to put them on the ponchos to carry them in. We ran out of ponchos, so we had to reuse the same ones over and over, and they became slippery with blood. When I would see the carrying parties drop one, I would go over and use Colonel Hal Moore's words to me at X-ray. Show a little respect. He's one of ours. A week after we got back to base camp, I came down with malaria and spent 3 months in Japan recuperating. When I came back to Alpha Company, Captain Forrest had moved on to some other job. One night I was sitting in the NCO club at Onhead drinking a beer with some other sergeants. There was a sergeant from Bravo Company, 2nd Battalion, 7th Cav there, and he said, "You know, we won that battle." Someone else said, "How do you reckon that?" And the Bravo Company sergeant said, "I know, because I counted the dead, and there were 102 American bodies and 104 gooks." Lieutenant Robert J. Jeanette, Ghost 4-6, Weapons Platoon leader of Charlie Company, 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry, was a big city boy, grew up in the Bronx, went to the City College of New York. He joined the ROTC program there and was commissioned in the Army in February of 1964. After officer basic and airborne training, Jeanette was posted for Fort Benning in the late spring of 1964. He was assigned to the 2nd Battalion, first as a rifle platoon executive officer, then as platoon leader. When the battalion got to Vietnam, the 23-year-old Jeanette was put in command of the weapons platoon of Charlie Company. Lieutenant Jeanette tells his story. "My weapons platoon had, I think, 3 81mm mortars. We were not really equipped as a rifle platoon. Some of us carried sidearms. I had an M16 rifle. I think there was one or two M60 machine guns. Everything was real peaceful up to the point where we were almost at the Albany clearing, the pickup zone. Then we began hearing some small arms fire up ahead. My platoon set up a little perimeter. We stayed right put there for 15 or 20 minutes. Then the word came down for us to form a skirmish line and move on up to the north. The LZ was to our west, and they were taking small arms fire up there pretty heavily. We did not get very far with our maneuver. The volume of fire was increasing, and now it completely enveloped us. There was essentially not much visibility unless you were standing up, and by now nobody was standing up. We could not see the enemy maneuvering at this time. I remember trying to set up perimeter and fire direction. I was trying to find out where the rifle platoons were. They were reporting a lot of casualties on the radio, saying their medic had gone down and asking for an aid man. I was crawling forward through the grass trying to move up a bit and see where those other Charlie Company people were. That's when I met my friend, the only enemy I'd seen to that point. He fired at me and I fired back. I got off one round of my M16 jammed. He was still firing at me and I scooted back first. When I got back to my perimeter, I picked up a .45 pistol from somebody. By now, our group was taking some casualties. Until now, the firing had enveloped us, but it was not, seemingly, aimed directly at us. Right after I got back, they found us. We were catching automatic weapons rifle fire and some light mortar or rifle grenades, airbursts right over our position. I don't remember where our mortar tubes were at this point. Our orders from Captain Fessmeyer, relayed by Lieutenant Don Cornett, had been to move out in a rifle skirmish line, nothing said about setting up our tubes. We may have left them when we moved out on that very brief maneuver. Now we were taking plenty of casualties. We were firing back as best we could, but we really had no visible targets. I tried to get the men to sweep the trees around us. My platoon was all still on our perimeter, all in the same area, spread out but still together. It was becoming very obvious we were surrounded and trapped, because now we began to take fire from all sides, every direction. two guys volunteered to try to break through and get help. I don't know what happened to them. Then I was hit the first time. That round hit me in the right knee. That afternoon I was hit two or three more times, some of it shrapnel from those airbursts. One was a rifle round that hit me square in my steel helmet right in front. It penetrated, but was deflected all the way around. I had a deep crease on my head, could feel the blood running down. Damned if I know how the next wound happened. From the time I was hit in the knee, I was flat on my back on the ground. But somewhere in there, I was shot in the buttocks. There was no medic, no one to bandage me. I just lay there losing blood. That went for everyone else there as well. There was nobody moving, nobody crawling out. There were some other Americans alongside our platoon, under better cover. It is quite possible we were taking some friendly fire, but there was no doubt we were getting enemy fire. The radio we had was on the battalion frequency. I remember hearing conversations that I would not have normally heard on the company net. Directions for air support, pilots asking direction where to lay the napalm. I got on once to tell them that their napalm was a little bit hot, a little close to where I thought there were friendlies. It wasn't that close to me, but I could see where it landed. I wanted them to know maybe they were hitting friendlies. They told me to get off the net, that they didn't want too many people talking. Anyway, I had a radio that was working on a good freck, and I wasn't going to give up either one. After I was hit, the other channels just went right out of my head, and I was afraid to start switching around for fear of losing all contact. Eventually, I think they changed channels for the battalion net. I know I stopped hearing all the chatter. Later, I had communication with some other people. By now, most everyone near me had been hit, too. I remember the guys who were under deep cover yelling at me, "Lieutenant, get your ass out of there." I yelled back that it was hard to move, that I was hit pretty bad. They yelled that they would help me crawl, and I told them there was no way I was going to leave the radio behind. That's when an amazing thing happened. We had a young private in the company who was constantly up on charges, a gold brick, a sad sack. Always in trouble. He got up and all that firing came over and said, "I'll take the radio and help you out of here, Lieutenant." As he bent over trying to get the radio out from under me, he took one right through the heart and fell over dead. Weeks later, in the hospital, I tried to get him a posthumous medal, but I never heard back. And now I can't remember his name. As it grew dark, I was still in the same position. I was trying to maintain contact with whoever I had talking to me back at brigade. There was a lull in the battle, and suddenly I am talking to an artillery outfit. The North Vietnamese were now running around the area, and we could see them moving. Bunches of 10, 20, more of them circling the perimeter of the landing zone. It was maybe 150 yards to the LZ perimeter, and the enemy were between us and them. I don't know how I got put on to that artillery unit. It took me a good while to convince them to bring artillery into that area. Finally, they tried a white phosphorus round or two. I couldn't see any of their rounds land, and WP rounds don't make near as much noise as high-explosive rounds. Finally, I persuaded them to start using the HE, high-explosive rounds, and then I could hear it and shift that fire into the area where we could see those enemy troops moving. I never really knew how effective that artillery fire I directed was until two things happened. Back in the States, a few months later, at St. Albans Naval Hospital in New York, I met somebody who had been in that fight, a 2nd Battalion 7th Cav guy, who came over and thanked me for that artillery fire. I was out walking the halls on my crutches for exercise, and he came up on crutches too. He had an empty trouser leg. He told me the artillery fire took his leg, but it saved his life, and he was grateful. I was stunned. Later on, around 1971, I had to appear as a witness at a court-martial at Fort Leavenworth, and I ran into Sergeant Howard of Charlie Company. He and some of his men were together in a position up ahead of me in the fight. Howard told me that every time the enemy got close to them, the artillery would come in close too and really whack them. He said that artillery fire was the only thing that kept the enemy away and kept them alive. It felt good to know that I did some good. And I had to argue with them to give me the HE. Somewhere in there, I really lose all sense of time. I know before dark and after dark, and that's about it. I remember I was on the radio that night talking to someone, telling them that we could hear groups of enemy walk by. We were hearing single rifle or pistol shots, that someone would scream or cry out, and then a single shot. I knew damned well what was going on. The enemy were killing or wounded. When the relief patrol came in, it was from my south, I think. I guided them to us by firing my .45 pistol. They picked up some American wounded further south who also had a radio on my frequency. When the patrol got to us, I could hear the patrol leader saying he never anticipated so many wounded. He was stupefied by the numbers. I know he asked who's in charge here. I heard him, but my mind didn't react for what seemed like a long time before finally I could say, over here. They brought a medic and he gave me a shot of morphine. That was the first shot I had. The first treatment I had for, I don't know, 12 hours or more. The medic put a tourniquet on my leg. The patrol leader told me that he couldn't take everyone, that he didn't have enough people to carry everyone. He said he had to leave me and the others with the medic and only take the worst hurt. I know the enemy came back at least once after they left. A party of 20 or 30 of them. We could see the enemy moving. It was a very clear night with a bright moon, maybe full or near full. After dawn, the relief came for us. Somebody gave me a canteen. I was dry as bone. During the night, the medic would only give me a sip or two. When the relief came, I know I guzzled a whole canteen. I can remember being triaged somewhere, maybe Holloway. Next thing I know, I woke up in a hospital ward at Quinone. A fellow officer, Paul Bonacorsi from Charlie Company, had been shifted out to liaison duty the week before the Yedrang, and he was the checking on C Company people. He told me there had been 108 men on the fit-for-duty report that morning we left for Albany, and only 8 on duty report the day after. I arrived at Fort Dix, New Jersey on Thanksgiving Day, 1965, and was ambulanced over to St. Albans Naval Hospital in the borough of Queens, the hospital closest to my home. I walked out of that hospital on Memorial Day, 1966. I was an outpatient for another 3 or 4 months, then was placed on temporary retirement that was made permanent in 1971. I was recalled to active duty briefly after that to testify at that court-martial at Leavenworth. That was the case of a Charlie Company enlisted man who had gone blind, raging drunk the week before Albany. He pointed his rifle at his sergeant and pulled the trigger. It dry-fired. Either it was unloaded or it misfired. Then he went off to try to shoot the company commander. He was sitting in the brig when we were out getting shot to pieces. He was court-martialed and sent to prison, but his conviction was overturned on appeal. So they retried him, and there weren't many left who could testify. Aftermath. Chapter 24. Mentioned in dispatches. In war, truth is the first casualty. Aeschylus. Late in the day, November 18th, Brigadier General Dick Knowles, whose headquarters were by now besieged by a growing throng of reporters demanding information on exactly what had happened at Landing Zone Albany, convened a news conference at 2nd Corps headquarters. The word that trickled in from the field was that an American battalion had been butchered in the Yedrang Valley, and the sharks were gathering. Knowles, who had been aware of the fighting at Albany since he overflew the battlefield at mid-afternoon the previous day, says, "I did not get timely information. We did not get it sorted out until the next day, the 18th. That's when we learned the details." Asked if Colonel Brown had reported what he had seen and heard during an early visit to the Albany perimeter the morning of the 18th, Knowles says, "No. It would appear then that NOSA's headquarters got its first real idea of the scope of the tragedy when Associated Press photographer Rick Marin, who had finagled a ride into Albany, returned to Camp Holloway mid-morning of the 18th and staggered into the 1st Cavalry Division press tent, pale and shaken by what he had seen and photographed, and told his colleagues that the 2nd Battalion 7th Cavalry had been massacred in an enemy ambush. Division Public Affairs Officer swiftly informed Knowles of the report by Marin. How and why it took more than 18 hours for the assistant division commander to get the first direct detailed account from the battlefield, and why that information had come not through command channels but from a civilian photographer, is a question that lingers. Knowles says, Lieutenant Colonel Hemphill had been getting pieces of information from the artillery and from all over that fit into a running description of a fight. But nobody, not even McDade, had the full magnitude until the next day. We kept getting body counts and casualty figures all that morning of the 18th. The reporters gathering in Pleiku thought they smelled a cover-up. The news conference that followed did little to dispel their suspicions. Knowles told the news conference that a battalion of the 1st Cavalry Division Airmobile had had a meeting engagement with an enemy force of equal or larger size, and the American battalion had suffered light to moderate casualties. Knowles reported that the enemy force had suffered 400-plus killed and had broken off the engagement and withdrawn. The cavalry battalion had held its ground and won a victory. The general summary of what he understood had happened at Albany was greeted by roars of disbelief from the assembled reporters. In short order, the wires were burning up with reports of the heaviest American casualties to date in the Vietnam War. Hints of an army cover-up of a disastrous ambush. Reports that the American forces were withdrawing. Some accounts said retreating from the valley. Much of the reporting was overstated and oversimplified. Some of it was just plain wrong. What had happened at LZ Albany was by no means a classic ambush. The element of surprise worked for the North Vietnamese and against the American column. Colonel Ahn's soldiers had between 20 minutes and an hour to maneuver into position to launch their attack. The battle at Albany encompasses something of all these precise definitions. There were a meeting engagement with the recon platoon at the head of the column, a hasty attack on the lead company, and a hasty ambush of the rest of the column, all of which occurred within a period of no more than 5 minutes. But the reporters were not the only ones who were skeptical about what they had been told and what they had not been told. That morning, November 18th at 10:15 a.m., the American commander in Vietnam, General William C. Westmoreland, visited 3rd Brigade headquarters at Kateka. During a 30-minute briefing, Colonel Brown failed to mention anything at all about the fight at LZ Albany, limiting his report to an overview of the X-ray fight. Later in the day, Westmoreland stopped by Quy Nhon and toured the Army 85th Evacuation Hospital. In his history notes journal entry covering November 18th, General Westmoreland wrote, "I flew down and visited the brigade commanded by Colonel Tim Brown. He gave me a briefing and we flew over the operational area. I then flew down to Quy Nhon, where I visited the men in the hospital. They were mostly personnel of the 1st Cavalry who had been wounded in the recent operation in Pleiku. While talking to them, I began to sense I had not been given the full information when I had visited the brigade CP. Several of the men stated they had been involved in what they referred to as an ambush. Most of the men were from the 2nd of the 7th Cavalry." The Westmoreland History Notes entry for the 18th add, "One other thing happened in the afternoon. After returning to my office from a trip to Pleiku, Colonel Ben Laguerre, MACV Public Affairs Chief, came in and informed me that a story had been filed that was highly critical of the 1st Air Cavalry. This came as no great surprise to me since I had suspected it after talking to the men in the hospital. I then called General Stanley Larson and told him to get the facts. I told Colonel Laguerre to send a plane load of press up the next morning in order to get a briefing on exactly what had happened." General Westmoreland was now concerned that the cavalry division had bitten off more than it could chew, and certainly far more than the American public was able to digest so early in the war. He also worried about sending South Vietnamese forces up against the North Vietnamese in the Ia Drang region. In his journal entry for Friday, November 19th, Westmoreland wrote, "General Bill Dupuy returned from Pleiku, where I sent him because of my concern that the